Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. During the holidays, Charles Dickens gets his due with performances and readings of his novel, A Christmas Carol. But Dickens also wrote A Tale of Two Cities, which begins with this sentence: "It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair, and we had everything before us. We had nothing before us. We were all going direct to heaven. We were all going direct the other way." It seems the words of that 19th century novel are applicable to today. We live in the best times Western civilization has ever known, and yet, from our political conversations and the undercurrent of dissatisfaction we're surrounded by, you'd never know it. As a whole, we are wealthier than previous generations. We live longer than they did. Most of us will never experience the struggles they did, but rates of anxiety and depression are rising, and that is especially true among the young. The reason might be found in one word: resiliency, or the lack of it. And our guest this hour believes that learning to get back up after we've been knocked down will not only make us stronger, it will make us happier. Neil Pasricha is the New York Times bestselling author of 6 books, including The Happiness Equation and How to Get Back Up. His latest is You Are Awesome: How to Navigate Change, Wrestle with Failure, and Live an Intentional Life. And he joins us for the hour from studios at the Canadian Broadcasting Company in Toronto. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me back, Mike.
You're welcome. Last time we spoke, we were wrapping up our work-life balance series and finding ways to find that balance. And you spoke about how to find fulfillment in and outside of work. But your work in recent years has focused on finding happiness and, as I said, living an intentional life. And your latest book is based both on research about resilience and about your personal experiences as well. What's the relationship between resilience and living that happy, intentional life?
Well, it's exactly like you said in that beautiful introduction. I do think we live in the best time ever. You know, we have the most stuff that we've ever had. We live longer than we've ever lived. We have more money than we've ever had. You know, our education rates are higher. And at the exact same time, as you pointed out, anxiety rates, depression rates, loneliness rates are rising. And I believe part of that is that we no longer have resilience. We no longer have the tools to handle failure because we have so little of it. You can press a button, a car picks you up. You press another button, and your food's going to be ordered and waiting for you on your front porch. And the other thing that happens is your phone entertains you the whole time you get home. So we don't have as much challenge as we used to, Mike. And as a result of that, when we do face the inevitable challenges that come through life, whether that's a breakup, whether that's loss of a job, then we don't know how to handle them. I believe resilience is a muscle that we all have somewhat atrophying inside ourselves right now. And it's a muscle we therefore need to think about and work on building.
Now, I know that you're a Canadian, so things may be different up north where it's very cold, but Americans have always professed in believing that you can pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and start all over again, that kind of an attitude. And yet, when we're suffering this resilience deficit, we don't have the tools to get back up after we've been knocked down. Why not? What happened? It seems that this stuff that was baked into our DNA has vaporized.
Yeah, two big reasons, I believe. Number one is we coddle our children, okay? I am a child who was coddled, right? We've got the gold stars and participation ribbons for everybody.
For nothing, kids used
kids used to have casts, remember? Broken arms, broken legs, you sign the cast at school. These days, how many kids you see walking around with casts? None. They just got black bags under their eyes from playing Fortnite all night. So we have this coddling of our children so that some people call it snowplow parenting. You know, you get rid of all the problems in their way so they don't face any. That's one. But the second big problem, and we can open this up a little bit more, is the smartphone. It is. Dr. Gene Twenge at San Diego University has done an incredible study showing that anxiety rate is up 30% over the past 5 years. And in her white paper, she actually says this is due to the ascendance of the smartphone. So there's a double whammy happening. We're easy on our kids, and at the same time, we're feeding them success stories from everybody else's Instagram account, which also makes us all feel worse at the same time.
I was just going to ask, is it really the instrument that is the smartphone or the apps that are on it that is causing this problem?
Mm-hmm.
It's social media that's delivered by this device, but the device isn't the problem. It's the social media apps that are on it.
Well, I think it's both, honestly, Mike. I think there's three P's of problems with cell phones, and they all start with the letter P conveniently. Number one is productivity. You know, McKinsey now says that we spend 31% of our time bookmarking, prioritizing, and switching between tasks. You notice that we're not actually doing anything. We're just deciding what to do. And for anyone listening that's ever stared at a Netflix screen trying to decide what movie to watch with your husband or wife on the couch at night, how often do you say half an hour later, after looking at trailers and looking at Rotten Tomatoes here, you're like, you know what? Let's just go to bed. Like, we haven't picked anything to watch yet because the process of choosing what to do is so time-consuming and agonizing. Same thing if you click open Spotify and you try to pick your music and you just get stuck there. So productivity is really suffering. The second thing, also starts with the letter P, is that there's a physical problem with our cell phones. Two physical problems, actually. When you look down at your smartphone, I don't know if you know this, Mike, you're applying 60 pounds of pressure to your spine, okay? And your thumbs, I don't know if you have this problem like I did. I went to the physiotherapist last year because I was like, my thumb doesn't work anymore. And you know what she said to me? All we do is thumbs now. You know, everyone's coming in with texting thumb or tech neck, they're calling it. Mm-hmm. Add to the fact that if you look at a bright screen, okay, within 1 hour of bedtime, your brain does not produce as much melatonin. That is the sleep hormone. You need that for a deep, restful slumber. If you ever wake up in the morning and you sort of feel groggy and like you didn't get a deep sleep, ask yourself, did you look at your cell phone right before bed? Something like 90% of us are sleeping within 10 feet of our cell phones. So we're looking at it last thing and first thing. Let me ask you a question. If you slept with a bottle of wine 10 feet from your bed, drank it before bed, and drank it when you got up in the morning, we'd all call you an alcoholic. Yet somehow our phoneaholicism we're not concerned enough about it. Okay? And the third P, which is the last one, is psychological. This is about social media, as you pointed out. When you look at Instagram, you are feeding yourself a litany of everyone else's greatest hits, and you are comparing that to your director's cut life. No matter how good your lunch is today, somebody's at a lobster buffet in the Maldives right now posting about it, so you're going to feel like your lunch was no good. So those three P's of problems, the productivity problem, the physical problem, that's with the thumbs and the neck and the melatonin, and the psychological problem are compounding into the fact that after we use our phones, we don't feel very good about ourselves.
So, I mean, I get that, and I get that maybe that particularly if you see all these Instagram posts, which are only showing you what the people you're following, the best parts of their life. They're not going to post their flat tire in the middle of a snowstorm on a highway in Montana. They're gonna show you their lobster dinner in the Maldives, and you're thinking, I can't even afford to go to the Maldives, and they're eating lobster there. So that may help us understand why we're so angry, and why depression is rising, and why anxiety is rising, because my life just isn't good enough. Nothing I can do can match that. But we're also among the most educated people the world has ever known. Why don't we recognize this in ourselves?
Well, I do think that these devices are quite addictive. I mean, I feel the reason I'm coming out so strongly against cell phone addiction is because I personally feel very addicted to it. And I have had to put some processes in place in my own life to kind of move me away from this drug. One of them is, by the way, buying an alarm clock. Our cell phones should not be plugged in near our heads at night. Okay? You got to plug it in your basement. Put it far away from you. So you create a 20 or 30 step movement from when you plug your cell phone in to when you get upstairs. The reason that's important is because you won't send those regretful 11 p.m. nasty emails or, you know, check what Trump tweets right before bed. It's not healthy. Okay? So that's one thing we need to do to create space. The second thing is, we are all talking in these days about something called intermittent fasting. I hear everyone talking about it. Oh, you know, how long can you go without food? After dinner or before breakfast? What we should be talking about, Mike, is intermittent fasting on our cell phones. There's a couple things to mention here. Number one is me, personally, when I get home on a Friday night, I actually hand my wife my cell phone and I say, do not give this back to me until fantasy football starts on Sunday. You know, like, give me a day off of this drug. Otherwise, I will instinctively walk over to the cupboard, pick it up, you know, without thinking and just like check who's texting me, who's emailing me. I'm addicted. Some people have also told me that they have started to purchase a device called a Palm Box. It's P-O-M-B-O-X. What it is it's a nice, beautiful piece of wood box. You put yourself in it, you set the timer, and the box does not unlock until the timer's done.
Oh, okay? My God.
I know. You shackle me from myself, right? Like, I had a woman email me and say, me and my husband, we're not paying attention to our kids at dinner. We felt bad about it. So now we put our devices in there from, like, you know, 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. every night, and we have a, you know, a mindful, intentional dinner with our family, put the kids to bed, and then we can go back on our cell phones. We have to become conscious of these devices. They are addictive, and they are feeding us. They are feeding us some of the anxiety that we're talking about.
I know cell phones certainly play a role in this, and social media plays a role in this, whether it's on the cell phone or on a laptop or someplace else. But younger people, I want to get back to this idea that younger people were raised perhaps differently than previous generations, that they were shielded by well-meaning parents from all things bad. They were rewarded just for showing up in many cases. And now that they're adults or older young people who are in college perhaps, they don't know how to cope in the real world where bad things do, in fact, happen all the time. Can those skills be learned at that stage of life?
Well, your wiser listenership right now will just be nodding and smiling, because I'm about to quote a study that you're gonna that kind of blew me away. Okay, as a 40-year-old man, but for anyone that's lived a lot of life and said, "Oh, that's happened before," they'll understand this. The study is called the End of History Illusion. It was done by Daniel Gilbert and a team of researchers at Harvard University. Daniel Gilbert is famous for writing the book Stumbling on Happiness. What happened to him personally? So this guy's like a Harvard professor. He's a psychologist. He's written books about positive psychology. He went through a divorce. He went through some hardship, and he thought, oh, in a year from now, my life is still going to suck. I lost a friend. I lost a relationship. I'm going to feel terrible in a year. After that year went by, surprise, surprise, he was okay. Okay? And then he did a study on 19,000 American adults between the ages of 20 and 70. And he asked all 19,000 essentially two questions. The first question was, so what's the last 10 years of your life look like? And then the second question was, what do you think the next 10 years of your life is going to look like? Would you believe that every single person answered with the last 10 years being a tempestuous portrait of ups and downs, right? Like, I was married to John, then I was married to Jesse, and that job I got fired from, and we had to move, and oh my gosh, it's been a wild 10 years. Everyone says that. You would say that. I would say that. We can all paint at our last 10 years as being wild ups and downs. Now, when you ask the same question to people, so what do you think the next 10 years are going to be like? Everybody says pretty much the same thing. Oh, well, I think I'll still be married to Jesse. I'll definitely still be at this company, and I certainly won't move. Everything will just continue. And again, this did not matter if the respondents were 20, 30, 50, or 70 years old. Why do I mention this study? Because we as human beings share a tendency together. We think that what is happening today in our lives is the end of history. We think if we get a divorce today or we lose our job today, we'll be stuck in the basement forever. We'll be dating forever. We'll be single forever. This mental catastrophizing is a commonality we all share. I mentioned before I started the study that your kind of wiser listeners will be smiling at this, because the thesis, of course, is the more challenges you get through, the more you recognize you will get through the next one. The problem, of course, is we have a tendency to think that the world is going to end now. And if you have a snowplow parent and you grew up in the 80s and 90s, or you're a millennial today and you're listening, then when your parents removed all the obstacles for you, you did not get that learning. And now when it hits you today, when you lose your first job, you're really mentally thinking it's over.
We're going to pick that up when we come back and pick it apart. And I understand young people with a little life experience not being able to see beyond the end of their nose. But if you've been around for a while, you'd think experience would tell you something. We'll come back and talk about that in just a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Neil Pasricha, the New York Times bestselling author of a number of books, I think 6 to 7 or 8 books, but the latest one is called You Are Awesome, How to Navigate Change, Wrestle with Failure, and Live an Intentional Life. And we've been talking about stages of life and how it never seems to get better, but because we always think we're in the same place and nothing is ever going to change. And we're talking about particularly young people where the incidence of anxiety is rising, depression is rising, and yet they're the most educated generation to ever come down the pike. We have more stuff, less suffering for the most part. We keep hearing these people being referred to as snowflakes by older people. You say we are turning into an army of porcelain dolls because of all the things that we've been talking about, people not having to experience defeat. You begin your book with a fable about a farmer who understands that, quote, every skyrocketing pleasure or stomach-churning defeat defines not who he is, but simply where he is. And you write, the farmer knows that what happens in life only serves to help him see where he is and decide which way to go next. I read that, and I thought, that's kind of Pollyanna-ish. But as you get into the story, maybe not. That's kind of what served most successful people, right?
Yeah, exactly. That fable is called The Fable of the Farmer with One Horse, and talks about how a farmer had one horse. His horse ran away. Everybody said, oh, this sucks. This is such bad news. He said, well, we'll see. And then the horse came back with 20 wild horses with it. So he corralled all the horses with his son, and everyone said, oh, you must be so happy. Now you got 21 horses. He's like, well, we'll see. One of the horses kicked his son, broke his legs, and everyone's like, oh, no, this is terrible. He's like, well, we'll see. Every able-bodied man was then drafted to war except for his son, who was spared, you know. And they were like, so this keeps yin-yanging back and forth. And it shows that, again, as you said, every skyrocketing pleasure or stomach-churning defeat defines not who he is, but simply where he is. Right, so now in society today, yeah, go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say, when I read that story, Donald Trump came to mind, and no, I'm serious. I'll tell you why in a second. And you're Canadian, and you don't have a horse in this race, so I think we can talk about this without being political. But a lot of times when he's just riffing, saying things to the press, ad-libbing off the cuff, he will end the phrase by saying, well, we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. Is he applying the farmer's knowledge? Is that what he's doing there? We'll see what happens?
He does seem to be a pretty resilient guy, don't you think?
Yes.
Teflon-like, exactly right. In fact.
Everything just falls off. Yeah.
In a way, there's something to that. There is some resilience to be able to take such blows up and down, left and right, as he has for years, and just keep navigating forward. Okay, I'm not going to speak positively about the guy in general, because, of course, there's so many issues from my Canadian perspective, but... Absolutely. And the other thing that Donald Trump does well, which you're mentioning with this example of the farmer, is he understands a core philosophy to build resilience, which is this. You have to lose more to win more. Okay? So many of us now, we get one job rejection or one resume gets dinged or one relationship does not work out and we think it's over. But I remember when I was a kid, before the internet, before Wikipedia, my dad gave me a book of baseball statistics. And I remember being shocked by the fact that the guy who had the most wins of all time in baseball, Cy Young, with 511 wins, he also had the most losses, too. This guy had 316 losses. Nobody has lost more games than Cy Young in all of baseball. So I flick over to the statistics on strikeouts. Okay, who's got the most strikeouts in baseball? Well, it's a guy. You know him. Nolan Ryan. 5,714. Well, would you be surprised to hear, Mike? He also has the most walks, 2,795. The thesis, of course, is it's not how many home runs you hit, it's how many at-bats you take. You have to lose more to win more. Sometimes people get stuck. I worked at Walmart for 10 years, and sometimes people in the office will say to me, oh, Neil, like, I need to find a new job, but, you know, it's so hard. Yeah, it is so hard. You have to hand out 100 resumes. You have to not hear back from 50 of them. You have to go to 25 first-round interviews. You have to get rejected from 24 of them. And one of them might say yes. You have to lose more to win more.
Yeah. You got to try. You got to be in the game.
People always talk right now about how many complete passes Tom Brady has or how many Super Bowl appearances, Super Bowl wins. It's like he's also got the most Super Bowl losses of any active quarterback at the same time. You know, so he's just played the longest. He's played more, so he's won more and lost more.
And you worked at Walmart. You also worked at Procter & Gamble for a while. And a lot of this of your thesis in this book is based on research, but it's also based on your personal experience. You write that 10 years ago, your wife left you. Your best friend committed suicide. You write about your getting booted out of Procter & Gamble, but you channel heartbreak into the simple practice of writing one awesome thing a day on the blog called 1,000 Awesome Things, which then turned into your first book. But that takes, I would think, strength to recover from losses like I just mentioned. Were there times when you sat down to write one of those 1,000 awesome things where you thought to yourself, who am I kidding? I got nothing.
All the time, all the time. Okay. And here's the beautiful thing. I'm 40 now, and this, what you mentioned about me, you know, my wife leaving our marriage, and I have to sell my house, and my best friend took his own life. I now, with the hindsight of 10 years, can talk to you openly and confidently and comfortably about that. It's been written about in this my new book, You Are Awesome. I talk about it there. But what you can't see, and this is why I had to learn it myself the hard way, is that was devastating to me. I lost 50 pounds due to stress. I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. I had to get therapy twice a week. I had to start living with my parents. I was a wreck. I was a mess for years. The blog, 1000awesomethings.com, was one tiny little outlet where I'd come home and I'd write about wearing warm underwear out of the dryer or getting called up to the dinner buffet first at a wedding or flipping to the coals out of the pillow. And these ingredients stirred together over years to eventually help me. Okay. Now, this is a marriage I wanted to just say. We'd been together 2 years, and most of that was long distance. I proposed after a couple months. Had I had experience with heartbreak or navigating relationship loss before, I might have been stronger through that. Okay. Here I am 10 years later being able to talk about it. So I actually felt pretty fragile at the time. That's part of the reason I wrote this book, because I'm like, why am I a 40-year-old man today, purportedly successful, and I feel like I have super thin skin? Somebody writes me an email, I dwell about it for days. I think I'm like, this relationship's over. They said something cruel to me. Or two people like my photo on Instagram. I'm like, I have no friends. How come nobody likes me? Why do I have thin skin today? And that's the research that created this book, because I was trying to figure it out for myself and, of course, now for my children, who I don't want to grow up with like the same anxiety and like worry that I've had.
The likes on social media and counting the likes on social media is the worst thing that has ever happened to people in the world, I think. You believe that a key part of happiness is learning how to deal with failure. And you say that that is something the convenience of technology has made people forget. So Let's parse that up and begin at the end. What's technology got to do with it?
Well, part of the reason that you just mentioned, I love that comment you just said about likes, is there's amazing research by Teresa Emma Bile at Brandeis University that shows that extrinsic motivators actually replace intrinsic motivators in our human brains, meaning the quantitative measure of things like likes, things like number of friends, replaced the original intrinsic motivator you used to have. When you first got Facebook, you know, whatever it was, 15, 20 years ago, it was like, oh, I get to see my friends' photos, and like I get to say hi to my auntie who lives in another country and I never get to talk to. Those were intrinsic motivators. We've replaced them with extrinsic metrics. The study that Teresa Mabile did showed that 12-year-old girls, when they were asked to teach 8-year-old girls the piano, were split into two groups. One group was told, you get the pleasure of teaching. The 8-year-old girl will say thank you. That's an intrinsic motivator. The other 12-year-old girls were taught, you get a movie ticket to one free movie when you're done the half an hour. Well, the girls that were paid the extrinsic motivator, the money or the movie, guess what? They were shorter tempered. They left right at the half an hour, and they were frustrated more easily, and the 8-year-old girls learned less. The ones that were given the intrinsic motivator, a simple thank you, they stayed longer, they were more patient, and the girls learned more. Extrinsic motivators replace intrinsic motivators. You asked about technology. That's a big problem with technology. We flood our brains with these numbers, and then we start counting those things rather than valuing the inherent work or friendship or connection that we used to.
Wow. So let's go back to the first part of that phrase. How does learning to deal with failure make us happy?
Because here's what happens in life. You go, you get up through life. Like I said, you have one knockdown. You get fired from your job. This is what happened to me at Procter & Gamble. So for those that haven't read the book, but what happened was my first job out of university was working at Procter & Gamble. It was like the star-studded job. I was like this young, amazing, like cubicle employee. I got this big marketing job. I was working for CoverGirl and Max Factor Makeup in the big city and getting paid a nice salary and all that stuff. Well, within months, I was put on a performance improvement plan. I start grinding my teeth. I start coming in early. I start coming in late. I can't figure out how to make the Excel spreadsheets add up. I'm like a complete mess. And I quit just before I got fired because I could not handle the emotional turmoil of navigating that. That's not just me, Mike. I have had a guy come up to me as recently as a few months ago say to me, my son got a scholarship to Duke University. He was top of his class in high school. He was a valedictorian, captain of the football team. He graduated from Duke with honors. He got one of these plum positions, and on his first day of work, his boss sent him a rude email, and he called me from his bed that night crying, saying, I quit, and I can't go back again. Like, that's the issue here. It's the incredible thin skin that we have, especially our young people, but I'm talking about myself too, and how do we grow that muscle of failure? I'm saying one of the ways to do it is to lose more to win more. Okay. Yeah. Another way to do it is something I call shifting the spotlight, right?
That's what I was going to get to, the spotlight. I'd never heard this before. And
well,
you say
I think,
in your – go ahead.
Yeah. No, ahead. Well, remember when they put on the front of the iPhone – here, I'm interrupting. When they put on the front of the iPhone the camera that faces yourself, remember? Like, mm-hmm. That was like a big deal. Like, oh, they have a new camera on the front. I was like, oh, my gosh, that's not going to be good for business. Because what that means is that we're so self-oriented. We are so self-focused. That's not necessarily a bad thing when it comes to building confidence. But unfortunately, when something bad happens, you think it's all about me. There's research from the University of Malawi that says that high performers are more likely than low or middle performers to blame themselves when trouble happens. So you do get dinged from a job, say. You think, I sucked. I didn't work hard enough. I didn't do well. It's all about me. You put the spotlight on yourself. What you need to learn how to do is to shift that spotlight. Recognize all the other variables that are involved. If you don't get into Duke University or you don't get into Yale, whatever, you could blame yourself, or you could say, they might not have had enough beds. There might be other candidates that are better. They might know more about me than I know about me to know that I'm not a good fit at that school or in that culture or in that environment. We have to see the huge gamut of possibilities that relate to how and why you are at a certain place.
You also have these two illustrations, very rudimentary stick figure illustrations of the spotlight effect and the impression that we all have that everybody is looking at us all the time.
Yes.
So everything that we do in life, and maybe this is exacerbated by the fact that people post everything about their lives and all these selfies, et cetera, on social media, but everybody is always looking at us. And then that's the picture we have of ourselves. And then you turn the page, there's another stick figure illustration illustrating the truth. Nobody is looking at us. No one cares.
They're all looking at their cell phones.
Exactly right.
Yeah, exactly. And just so you guys know, I'm making up this phrase. Like it came from Cornell University. It comes from in the year 2000. This researcher, Thomas Gilovich, came up with it. It's called the spotlight effect. And just so you know, the study, they asked Cornell students to estimate their abilities in the eyes of others in three areas: their physical appearance, their athletic accomplishment, and how well they played a video game. Guess what? The participants constantly overestimated the extent to which their strengths and weaknesses would be noticed by others. The researchers said that fear of judgment contributes to social anxiety and gnawing regret. Again, think of the camera on the front of the iPhone. Think of what we're doing on Instagram, showing how good we look, you know, with this perfect selfie that's edited and you know, it's got these filters on it and makes us look pretty on the top of the mountain. We are so oriented toward ourselves that now when anything bad happens, we then blame ourselves for it. We have to recognize that we're part of one energy here. We've got 99.9% of the same DNA. We are the same species. We all want the same things: to be recognized, to be loved, to be noticed, to be appreciated. Simple, simple stuff. All about us.
Can you be successful and not care what other people think?
Great question. The way I define confidence is actually having a high opinion of yourself and having a high opinion of others at the same time. So if you have just the first and not the second, you're arrogant. If you have just the second and not the first, you're insecure. If you have both, it's confidence. So the goal here is not to just think you're great, but to think everyone's great. If you can recognize that, again, like I said, we're all in this together. We're all trying. We're all working hard. Nobody gets up in the morning trying to do a bad job. I have a quote in You Are Awesome where a manager that I worked with at Walmart got a strip torn off him in a meeting. All the executives jumped on the guy because he didn't meet his monthly numbers or whatever. And the CEO, who was kind of an older, wiser gentleman who I really respected, he said, he doesn't need to know he's doing it wrong. He needs to know how he does it right. Oftentimes, the angry and underperforming employee in an office is just underperforming and nobody helped them. Yeah. Part of shifting the spotlight is helping each other recognize that it's a team game and working more in a community and a society where we take care of each other.
So failure hurts. Particularly the first time you fail at something, it really hurts because it shakes your confidence. You think you're no good. You think you're always going to be no good. You think everybody else is better than you. Everybody's looking at you. Everybody knows you failed, and it hurts. But then we get back to this end of history illusion that you spoke about a few minutes ago, where we think we are where we are today is where we're always going to be now and forevermore. And that's the truth whether you're at the top of the heap or at the bottom of the heap. If you're extremely successful, you think, well, I'll always be successful. The money will always be coming in. If you're at the bottom of the heap, you think, I'm never going to be any better than I am right now. Why even try? When in fact, change happens all the time. So what you have to understand is you have to be resilient, which is what your book is about. So do you learn resiliency or do you build resiliency?
You build it by going through it step by step by step. I told you guys, we just talked about my divorce and how devastating that was for me. Here's the other thing, though. That was my first legitimate real breakup of my life, Mike, okay? Mm-hmm. Right. I stumbled upon a study in the Telegraph over in the UK about how they interviewed a bunch of people who were in real long-term loving relationships. And they interviewed those people and they said, well, how many relationships were you in before this one? And did you cheat or get cheated on? How many people did you kiss? And they tallied all these interviews up together. And guess what? According to the study, the average woman who is in a loving long-term relationship today has kissed 15 people, had 7 sexual partners, 4 one-night stands, 4 disaster dates, 3 relationships less than a year, 2 relationships over a year, fell in love twice, has been heartbroken twice, cheated once, and been cheated on once, all before she found a lifelong partner. The stats for men were almost identical, but the men kissed 16 people, had 10 sexual partners, 6 one-night stands, and 4 disaster. So they're skewed a little bit higher. But the point is, we take that one disaster date or that one thing, we say, well, this is it. It's my life is over. But according to the study, the average long-term loving relationship has had so many more than the one you're going through. Can you zoom out? Can you see that? Right? Can you help yourself along the path to know that resilience is being built by every experience that you've had?
Neil Pasricha is our guest. He's the author of You Are Awesome, How to Navigate Change, Wrestle with Failure, and Live an Intentional Life. And never, when we've talked about these kinds of things in the past, has the word ellipse ever come up. The famous dot, dot, dot. But it will in this conversation when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Neil Pasricha about resiliency, about picking yourself up, about how to build that feeling, because it's not being taught, and younger generations are having real trouble with it because they've lived coddled lives and because of the interference of social media. His book is called You Are Awesome, How to Navigate Change, Wrestle with Failure, Live an Intentional Life. Just before the break, we were talking about how to build, the fact that you have to build resiliency. And one way to do it, you say, and this really surprised me actually, is participating in unconventional, weird side hobbies. Give me some examples of that.
Well, basically what happens, according to the research, is that as we get older, we all suffer from something called cognitive entrenchment, which is a phrase that I learned recently and I love. Because what happens is, think about ninth grade gym class, Mike. Everybody is doing 10 different sports. You got volleyball one week, and then you got basketball, and then you got track and field, and then you got soccer, whatever. But if you ask the average adult, hey, what do you play any sports? They either say, like I do, none, nothing, or like one, like I jog or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. What happens is then you get so deep down your one specialty that you no longer have the ability to try anything new. However, the interesting thing is our learning rate is the steepest when we know the least. Okay. Add to that the fact that there's an amazing study on Nobel Prize winners. turns out that Nobel Prize winners are 22 times more likely than their scientific peer groups to have a strange, weird, unconventional, amateur hobby far outside their scientific discipline. Meaning, they're also teaching magic at kids' birthday parties. They are glass-blowing. Okay, they are starring as Horatio in the local town play. And all three of those examples I just mentioned are real examples from the study. Okay, in order to avoid cognitive entrenchment, as we get older, to build mental resilience, to avoid intellectual fragility, you always need to have something weird or unusual far outside your discipline. Take a cooking class in a cuisine that you've never tried before. Go to a music concert or sign up for a musical instrument that you've never played a note of, but you always thought, I wonder what it'd be like to play the trumpet. Sign up for 6 classes. Pay so much that you have to go because you'll feel bad if you waste your money, you know? And then you put yourself in an unconventional discipline.
What does that do for you?
Well, here's the thing. Nobody knows how our brains work, okay? But what they do is your brain makes incongruent learnings from one discipline apply to everything else. So Steve Jobs, famous CEO, founder of Apple Computers, was famous for saying the reason Apple Computers took off, part of the reason was because they had this great font. The reason they had the great font is because he took a bird course at Reed College when he was much younger in calligraphy. He's like, if I hadn't taken that calligraphy course, I never would have known how to design a font for a computer, which of course was copied by every other computer. He had no way of knowing when he took calligraphy at Reed College that it would apply years later in his technological pursuits at Apple. But it did. Chris Anderson runs something called TED. Okay, people will be familiar with maybe TED Talks or the TED Conference. I interviewed him for my podcast, Three Books, and he said, Neil, that's exactly how I designed the TED Conference. It's a series of incongruent, seemingly unrelated ideas, yet by the end of the TED Conference, every attendee has a giant, poignant aha in their actual discipline. The brain, we don't know how it works, but we do know that when we feed it, totally different ideas. Maybe going swimming, if you never swam or you take a Italian cooking course or you sign up for trumpet lessons, maybe in your job as a coder, you'll have an interesting aha, or you'll think of an unusual or unique way to do it. That's what resilience is, right? It's partly making sure your brain doesn't fall into the trap of doing one thing over and over, so when you get jostled by something new, you don't know how to handle it.
Hmm. You say something interesting in this book that perhaps people haven't thought about. You say that success blocks future success. That seems counterintuitive. You would think that one success would build on the previous one. Why do you believe that success blocks future success?
It's very related to the point I was just saying about cognitive entrenchment. What I'm saying is, okay, let's just say you're 25 years old. You don't know what you want to do with your life. So, you know, someone kind of casually encourages you to maybe get your real estate license. You try it out, and 3 weeks later, guess what? You sold your first condo. You take home a nice commission. You're like, wow, that really worked. Yeah, maybe I'll just bury my dreams of becoming a ballerina, and I'll just check this out. What happens now? You go to parties. Everyone knows that you're the guy that sells condos. You're the person that's into real estate. They ask you questions. All those conversations serve to deepen your own knowledge in that area. You become a successful real estate agent. Congratulations. However, by age 35, even though you might be making money selling real estate, you may never have known what could have happened had you followed those dreams of becoming a ballerina. Or you may never know what could have happened if you didn't follow all the other options. The thesis here is that we have to stay wide as long as possible. We have to avoid specializing too soon. If you've got your kid in violin lessons and they're 7 years old and they just go deep into violin, well, who knows what else they might have liked, what other sports they might have tried, what other games they might have invented or played, or what. We have to be wide the long. Success blocks future success because it serves to give you positive feedback that you just chase forever.
Okay, so let's talk about that, because that's something that really is a recent phenomenon, I think, with parents and their kids. As a kid growing up in the Pleistocene age, we did everything. No, seriously, we did everything.
Yeah.
We said we played softball, we played touch football, we played we went outside and rode bikes, we played musical instruments, we were in the theater department at school, whatever. But we did more than one thing. Today, if you find out that your kid likes or has a particular talent in baseball or soccer or whatever it may be, you're all
in. You get a
second
mortgage on the house.
That's
and
right.
You dump all that money into tennis lessons.
Exactly.
I know.
You're all in, which means, and you do that because there's a future in the NFL for your kid if you get him in football at the age of six. and he mm-hmm. shows a talent for it, and that's all you concentrate on. Well, maybe that's true. Maybe that will lead to great success professionally. But you're saying that it would be better for the kid to do other things and maybe not be a pro football player or pro soccer player?
Well, not just that, but we have a mistaken assumption as parents that you have to specialize sooner if your child is going to have a chance to compete with those quote-unquote best in the world others that are doing the same thing.
I mean, however, ice skaters have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and get ice at 5 o'clock in the morning, they've got to do it every day.
It's a false assumption, Mike. It is. There's a great book that's just been written about this. It's called Range by David Epstein. He compares Tiger Woods, who was specialized at a very young age, with Roger Federer, who did not specialize in tennis until a very old age. Well, look at Roger Federer today. He's fantastic, and he's been at the top of the sport for decades, you know, and he didn't specialize in the tennis till a very old age. And how often do you hear when you're watching TV and you do hear about an NFL player or an NBA player saying, "Oh, he just went into NFL. He just went into football in college. He was always a first baseman," or vice versa, right?
Yeah.
It is healthier for your mind and for your body to get out of cognitive entrenchment, to try many things as long as possible, to avoid specializing too early. It creates mental resilience, and it creates the ability to try new things over time. If you specialize too soon, then you become intellectually fragile. Same as the 25-year-old selling condos that just does that for the rest of their life. Who knows what else they could have done if they just held themselves back?
Does it also play into what we've been talking about? The fact that if you don't specialize, if you do a lot of different things, you're going to find out that you're not good at some of those things, or that you are good at other things. But the fact that you're not good, you're going to probably stop at some point doing those things because it's not good. It doesn't feel good to fail. But you've had the experience of having failed. And you say you need to learn how to see failure from the perspective of this is going to go somewhere positive. So is mm-hmm. that what you're talking about there?
Am I conflating?
No,
you're right, Mike. Here's the thing. Well, you have a fender bender. You think, "Oh, I'm a bad driver," right? Mm-hmm. People talk, your pitch gets rejected at work. You think, "I'm not creative." You get a bad blood test from your boss or from your doctor, not your boss. You get a bad blood test from your doctor and you think, "I don't take care of myself." This is what we do. We put a period at the end of our sentences. I heard you say earlier we're going to tease out the idea of this ellipsis. What we should be doing is adding a dot, dot, dot. Okay?
Okay.
So what you should be saying, let's go backwards now, is I don't take care of myself, dot, 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 yet. I'm not creative, dot, 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 yet. I'm not a good driver, dot, 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 yet. I can take a couple lessons. I can improve. Again, that little simple mind shift of changing a period to a dot, 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 or an ellipsis actually opens the door again to you learning and getting better. If you get stuck after that fender bender or after that pitch gets rejected or after that bad blood test, I always say ask yourself three questions, three simple questions. That'll help. Number one, will it matter on my deathbed? Number two, right? You don't zoom out. What happens today is not going to matter at the end of your life. Number two is, can I do something about it? Ask yourself that. If you can, great, do it. If you can't, you can't. You're stuck. Stay there. You're fine. And the third thing, is this a story I am telling myself? Very important, especially for young people today. You know what people say to me when I speak at college campuses? They say, "Oh my gosh, I failed biology. I failed my parents." No, you failed biology. You didn't fail your parents. That's a story that you're adding on top. People say, "Oh, you know, nobody trusts me. I'm an alcoholic." Okay, you might be an alcoholic, but you're adding that story of nobody trusts me. So often what we do is we take the simple thing. Oh, I got a bad blood test. I don't take care of myself. I am unhealthy. I am no good. I am obese. Whatever, you add these stories on top. Husk it away. Ask yourself those three simple questions. Will it matter on my deathbed? Can I do something about it? Or is this a story I'm telling myself?
And you say, tell yourself a different story.
Yeah, you can replace it in your mind. You can decide to tell yourself a different story. Have a fender bender? Just getting in some driving practice, learning how to be better. Pitch gets rejected? I'm better for the next one, right? Got a blood test from the boss, or blood test from the doctor, keep saying boss. That's fine. Now you have an indicator to how to shift your dashboard. Now you're more provoked to sign up for that half marathon that you were thinking about. Hmm. Tell yourself a different story.
Failure is regarded by a lot of people, particularly younger people, as a disaster, and they'll never recover from it. That's all that we talked about that before, about this end of history illusion that you failed and therefore you will always be a failure. It will never get better. And you tell a story in the chapter you called Secret Number 3 about being fired. I'm in broadcasting. There are two kinds of people in broadcasting. Those who have been fired and those who are waiting to be. That's just how it is. That's just how it is. So I have been fired several times. And I remember the first time I was fired, it was devastating because I was so wrapped up in who that person was that no longer was that person. But I have talked to people and I have experienced this to be true myself. And you've talked to person and you said that every person you've ever talked to who has been fired told you the same thing. Getting fired was the best thing that happened to me. Every single person, I'm here to add to that. It's true.
Yeah.
How do you see that, though, when you've just been handed your pink slip?
Well, I share the story in You Are Awesome, but how the fact is, when I was in human resources at Walmart, part of my job was going with managers and employees into the room when there was a termination happening or someone's getting fired. I was there for the handshake. I was there to explain the paperwork. I was there to help people pack up their box and take it to the trunk, and a lot of tears. I mean, this stressed me out, as you can imagine. And you know what they'd say to me? I'll never find anything again. My life is over. I've been here 20 years. How could this happen? But when I'd bump into those same people again, it's a small industry, in retail. I bump into them at a conference or whatever. They say, yeah, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I got to spend 6 months with my daughter after her miscarriage. I got to actually start that business that I've been telling myself I wanted to for years. I finally got to visit my parents and my grandparents in their home country like I'd been saying I would. Like, how do we get there? It's remembering that history does not end right now. That's the end of history illusion, okay? Right. You have to remember that the 19,000-person study that they did said everybody said the last 10 years was, tumultuous, and the next 10 years are going to be the same. So you think it's going to be the same, but it's not. It's a trick our brain is putting on ourselves. You have to navigate forward day by day. One of the things, by the way, Mike, that helps you navigate forward is, I say, start your day with a simple 2-minute morning practice in order to strengthen your mind every single day. That should help you. Instead of waking up and checking your cell phone, I say, write down on a piece of paper something you will let go of, something you are grateful for, and something you will focus on. It takes 2 minutes. It's a simple practice. Strengthen your mind every day as a daily practice, and that will help you navigate the ups and downs that come in
life. Do you write down the same things every day, or is it something different every day?
Well, the interesting research shows that when you write down, I will let go of, and you write down, say, the 5 pounds I gained over the holidays, or in my case, comparing my book to Tim Ferriss's book, which is selling many more copies than mine, or even like the negative email I sent to my boss or to my executive assistant last night, I feel bad about, or yelling at my kids or whatever it is, then according to the research, we actually let go of it. I mean, it's true. This is the Catholic confession chamber idea, If you tell people the thing that's bothering you, it actually leaves you. You stop worrying about it. So do I write down the same thing every day? No. In fact, Mike, when I look at my journal, I actually can't even remember some of the things I wrote down. I'm like, what email did I say? Who am I comparing myself to? What 5 pounds? By writing it down, we actually exorcise it from our minds, and we stop thinking about it all day. So that's why I will let go of is a very powerful first step.
One of the things I want to talk about, we only have maybe 60 seconds left, but you have two suggestions that may seem like the best way to disaster, but you say the reverse is true. Your ambitions should exceed your abilities, and you should lose more to win more. We talked about that, but what about this ambition exceeding your abilities?
Yeah, so I talk about this because when I started that blog, 1000awesomethings.com, what I didn't tell people at the time was it was like my 15th blog. I had started about 14 other blogs. And I cataloged them all and You Are Awesome. And they all sucked. No one visited them. No one ever came. They were just disasters. Okay? But I think the point that we often miss here is that what was happening for me is my ambitions for what I wanted to create on a website were far exceeding my own abilities. What's the point? That's a good thing. Aim higher than you're able to do. Recognize that that's a feature, not a bug, and then you'll keep going forward and moving faster day by day.
You also say that you have three words of advice. Go to parties where you don't know anyone, have a failure budget, and count your losses. I don't know, but we don't have time to talk about those things, but you can find out about them through Neil Pasricha's blogs and also his book, You Are Awesome, How to Navigate Change, Wrestle with Failure, and Live an Intentional Life, among his other books. Thank you so much for the hour.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.